And welcome back to yet another episode of Minority Reports podcast and digital series. I'm your host, Mona Sheikh. We have an incredible guest today. He's an OG. I have looked up to him for as long as I can remember. He has an amazing movie out called Just Like Us. He was one of the original comics to tour in Axis of Evil tour. My very, very funny guest, Ahmed Ahmed. How you doing? I know you've been doing a lot of Instagram lives.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, trying to stay busy like everybody else right now. I'm trying to kill time, and I figure why not take this sort of kind of, I'm doing more of like what you're doing, more podcast approach. I'm not trying to be like, you know, fun for the whole family. It's not a sticky kind of thing I'm doing. I'm going for more like just intellectual conversations, yeah. Trying to figure out, you know, people's backstories. I think people are interested to hear people's backstories, how they got started and how we met, stuff like that.
Absolutely. The way you had it before, that works right there.
Like this?
Yeah, that works.
Let me turn this fan off.
You probably get the fan bothers you?
I just feel like it might bother people watching, like watching this helicopter.
Just like hovering over you.
Hold on, sorry.
It's all right. So now
we how many times you got to pull it.
No, is it good now?
Yeah, I think it'll stop at some point. I think it's good.
All right, let's go to the conversation that you recently moved back to LA. I know this is like take two, but you moved back to LA because you were in Asia for 2 years, did you say?
Yeah, I moved to Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia in January 2018.
Okay.
I spent 2 years living there, but I toured and traveled in about, I think, 8 or 10 countries around Asia. So I got to really see Asia, you know, from the inside out. And then I just kind of feel like I get enough there for now.
I went
there to kind of like help bring value to the comedy scene there, which I think I did a little bit.
Yeah.
But they have a far and long way to go.
Right.
Just because they're not as advanced as the U.S. And I would say Australia, the U.K., Canada, Asia, and the Middle East, you know, Southeast Asia, those countries are just so new to like contemporary stand-up comedy. So I feel like I need to kind of incubate a little bit, and I'll probably go back at some point.
Right. I mean, when you do comedy in Asia, like, how much of a difference is it? Like, do they get the references that you're making? Like, are they like very, I guess, worldly in that sense, or a lot more aware about what's happening? Do they get your references, or is it like
if you go to my website and just go to my YouTube channel, like right on my homepage, I've posted a couple clips. Some of them of recent jokes. But one particular clip in front of 1,500 people in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia.
Wow.
And Malaysia consists of Indian, Black, and Malay. I'm sorry, Indian, Chinese, and Malay. So you have three different cultures kind of dominating the whole country, technically. And but the audiences that we were performing in front of are like English-speaking crowds. They all are on the internet. They're following American stand-up comedy. So they got, you know, almost all the references. I didn't have to switch my act up much.
Yeah. I guess American comics, we always think like, oh, what would the comedy would be so different when we go abroad? Like, are they going to understand our, you know, references that we're making? But I guess that's not the case. I mean, and what kind of drove you to go to Asia? Like what, I mean, you've been here forever and you were in LA forever. What kind of made you go, you know, I'm going to go to Asia?
Well, first of all, to comment on your first comment, I feel like back in the day, you know, American comics probably would be misunderstood in other countries, but because the internet made everything available, I mean, you have people from different countries quoting, you know, Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld and, you know, everybody loves Raymond, and everybody, and you know, I'm doing a bad Arabic accent, but my point is,
That's your people. You can do that accent.
They all watch American stand-up comedy, so it was a real easy transition of just, we were there at the right, you know, right place, right time.
Right.
Axis of Evil was just about to take off in the U.S.
Right.
Some producers in Dubai, you know, caught wind of it. I was able to kind of pitch them on the idea. We sold the concept in the Middle East.
Right.
And it became like groundbreaking in history, you know, made history. But
that's right.
So to answer your question on that, yeah, now it's more available. Big American comics are traveling or were traveling to the Middle East and Asia monthly and getting paid a lot of money.
Yeah.
And the comedy club scene is starting to sprout a little bit and that kind of thing. But they still have probably a good 10 years, if not more, before it's completely crystallized and involve like the American scene.
Yeah, yeah.
And your other question was
I'm always fascinated by, you know, I feel like when you come from like a background of like being Middle Eastern or South Asian, and you know, trying to crack the code of stand-up comedy in America, or even in the West in general, I feel like you have to be like so on top of your game. Like you gotta be the best of the best. Like you can't come in with turkey jokes, right? You can't come in with like turkey sandwich jokes and like expect people to be like, oh my God, yeah, yeah, that's totally cool. No, you gotta bring your stuff.
I mean, yes and no. I've seen really bad comics do very well in the Middle East and Asia because people just don't know anything.
Like a Middle Eastern and South Asian background?
Both. All across, you know, I've seen, you know, really bad comics do really well because those audiences aren't educated to the comedy culture like America and the UK and Canada and Australia, you know, are. So there's a bit of a divide and a silver lining of like what's funny, what's not funny.
Sure.
Also, as you know, comedy is subjective. It can be funny to one person, not to the next. So
That's right. I mean, you know, let's go back to your kind of path and your journey. And sorry, I know we're like going back and repeating this because I don't know what the hell happened to my entire video. I was trying to convert it and I don't know what the hell happened. Again, an epic failure of technology on my part. What is wrong with me? I am not a good brown person. That's what it is. I just totally missed out. I have four older brothers. Oh.
I thought I turned it off.
The fans. It's the fans, man.
Conspiracy theory.
Listen, the fans, they won't leave you alone. The fans won't leave you alone, man.
Literally, the fans.
Literally, the fans will not leave you alone. I just think, let's go back to your background of, you know, you were born in Egypt, and then you moved when you were 1 month old, which is practically being born in the U.S., unlike me that moved as a teenager from Pakistan at 15. You know, your background is you started off as an actor. What was that conversation like with your family to be like, hey, I want to be an actor?
Yeah, you know, I'm the oldest son. There's six children, four girls, two boys. You know, we were, as you know, if you come from a brown family from Southeast Asia or the Middle East, you're destined to be a doctor, lawyer, engineer. That's the sort of the go-to kind of thing. And I just didn't have any interest in that. I was always interested in the arts and theater and acting and comedy and music and that kind of thing. So when I was 19, I was very brave. I went to my mom and dad and I said, I'm going to move to Hollywood and pursue entertainment and acting and comedy and stuff. And my dad says, what are you, Ege? And I was like, huh? You're Ege. And I was like, there's no such thing as being Ege, first of all. Second of all, no, I'm not. Look at me.
I'm 6'3". Look at me. Look at this manly body. What are you talking about?
I mean, that's not to say, you know, who knows? A gay guy could look like me. My thing is I don't have any gay tendencies. So I was like, well, that's out of the question. Then he's like, well, then you're going to join a cult. And I was like, yeah, it's called Hollywood.
Right?
Duh.
What about your mom? Was she cool? Was she supportive or just your dad?
So my dad didn't talk to me for 7 years. He would look at me like when I would come, because I packed my car and I drove to LA literally with $20 in my pocket. My mom gave me $20 and she goes, La ilaha illallah. Like she was like very afraid for me that I was going to get sucked up in the darkness. And I did actually a couple times, but she was just more concerned for my well-being, whereas my dad was like ashamed and embarrassed that his son let him down, right? Mm-hmm. Because his friends and his coworkers and colleagues, you know, like Muslim men, Egyptian men, you know, they all, the Arabic men, whatever, Pakistani, and they all sit around and they like to, you know, so what did your son doing?
That's right.
Oh, my son Mustafa, he just got his PhD from this college, and he's going to MIT for that, and he's going to be an engineer, and blah, blah, blah. What about you? My son's going to be a physician. He got a job at the biggest hospital in Los Angeles. We're very proud. Abu Bakr, how about your son, Ahmed? He is a gay. He moved to Hollywood, Hawal. He wants to be actor, comedian, bullshit. He's a gay.
So he carried
the burden of whatever journey I was going to be on. All Muslim parents do that, regardless with children, religion, culture, marriage.
Yeah.
If you don't do something that they want you to do, they have to answer to God, not you.
That's right. Absolutely. I mean, with my, like you said that you didn't speak to your dad for 7 years. My family didn't speak to me for 8 years. And I think your mom in your sense, like, you know, kissed the $20 and gave it to you. That wasn't the case for me. I was just turning 18. I lived with my four older brothers here. My parents lived in Pakistan. And I remember coming out of the artist closet in front of my four older brothers and saying, hey, listen, I want to be an artist. Like, I don't want to, you know, I was a stage actor in New York for the longest time. You know, I want to be an artist. And my brothers literally gave me an ultimatum. They said, either you're going to go to college, become a physical therapist, which I don't know why the hell they were obsessed with. I don't know why physical therapy. Or we're going to send you back to Pakistan and mom's going to marry you off to someone. So you take your pick. Those were literally my options, okay? And I was like, I cannot wait to turn 18 so I can just pack my shit and leave. And one night I got into a massive fight with my family. I packed my shit and I left, and it was a war. I called for war. I mean, girls don't leave their parents' home until they're married off to a guy. Like, that's it. That's
normal. I know. I have four sisters, so I've seen it. I've lived it. I've seen my parents, like, ridicule my sisters. You know, and try to marry him up, huh?
Ridicule them about what?
Well, my oldest sister, they tried to do like an arranged marriage. She wasn't having it.
Yeah.
My other sister, Amira, who you know.
I love Amira.
You actually remind me of her a lot. She did the same thing. She's like, I'm not living under this roof anymore. I make my own money. I'm going to do my own thing.
Yeah, she's a sassy gal is what she is.
She's sassy. And she got out, but my parents respected her because her journey was to be an entrepreneur, and she couldn't do it under my parents' roof, like literally, you know.
Sure, sure. Absolutely. I mean, are all, besides, so I know Amira's not married. Are your other sisters all married?
My oldest sister's married with two kids, and then the sister right under me married with two kids, and then Amira and Sarah not married.
Oh yeah,
and I have a brother too.
Oh, got it. And is your brother married too?
He is not. He has a daughter, but he's not married. He does have a live-in girlfriend though.
Got it. Okay, so he's in a relationship. Yeah, I'm always like fascinated by you know, people who are in the business and how they're able to sustain an intimate relationship or like a significant other. I mean, God knows that I struggle with it because I have my own shit to deal with. But I feel like, you know, I guess we all have our issues to deal with. 13 years of therapy, baby. What's up? But I think, what do you think, like, do you feel like you have been the person who has you were like the first person to make history by passing at the Comedy Store? Because Mitzi Shore passed you, right?
Yeah. I used to run little alternative comedy nights like during the week around Hollywood. And one of the biggest ones, if not the biggest show I ever co-ran and created with Jay Davis was called Dublins. And it was, I think it was probably before your time, before you got to LA, but it was right on the Sunset Strip. It was between the Comedy Store and the Laugh Factory. And at that time, those two clubs were really dying. People weren't going to comedy clubs for some reason. Well, a lot of the reason was the comedy scene was a little saturated, the club scene, but also you can watch all your favorite stand-up comedy or comedians on sitcoms.
Right.
So at the time, Roseanne Barr, Everybody Loves Raymond, you know, Bill Cosby before he was, you know, Bill Cosby, you know, Seinfeld, Tim Allen, you know, every, you know, In Living Color, Jim Carrey, Damon Wayans, like, yeah. There was a lot of stand-up comedy on TV. People didn't have to leave their homes. They can just watch it on TV, kind
of. Not the same, but that's not the same as watching stand-up. Like, that's the...
No, but I'm saying America got lazy because because, you know, it costs a lot of money to take your wife out or girlfriend out on a date to a comedy club, right? Parking, tickets, 2-drink minimum, you know, food, popcorn, whatever the hell you get, you're spending $100-$300 maybe.
Sure.
And so I think people just got lazy and they're like, I can just catch it on TV. But at any rate, those clubs were dead and we started this club called Dublins. It was above Dublins, like Bublin at Dublins, Jay-Z. And every Tuesday night for 4 years, rain or shine, 300 people would pack in there.
Yeah.
A lot of celebrities were coming in there. Some people I knew, some I didn't. We always had great comics, hot chicks, and a cool DJ. This guy, Crash, would spin music.
Yeah.
And then every week, you know, it was like Alonzo Bowden, Sebastian Maniscalco, Joe Rogan, Dan Cook. Dan Cook will, to this day, admit that he became famous at Dublin's, basically.
Wow. This is 90s?
Dave Chappelle. This is late 90s, like 98, 99. It was 98, 99. Yeah. You know, we had Roseanne Barr, we had Dave Chappelle, we had Daryl Hammond, Jeff Richards, Bobby Lee. I mean, the list goes on and on, Bret Ernst.
Right.
And the room just kind of got this life to it, like this new sexy culture of comedy, right?
Right.
And I remember some really very funny, but physically unattractive comedians would call me on the weekly and say, hey man, can I get 5 minutes of stage time tonight? And I was like, oh, we already have like, you know, 11 comics. It's going to be a long show.
Yeah.
Please, just 5 minutes. I'll get off at 4:30. I just need to get laid.
What?
And I would say, I haven't been laid in 2 months and I'm battling depression. I would say, all right. So at Dublin's,
these are all guys, right? These are guys calling.
Of course.
Okay. Just want to make.
You think a woman would call me and say, I need to get laid? Can you give me stage time?
I don't know, man. I don't know. There's a bunch of desperate bitches out there. I don't freaking know. I don't know.
Anyway, I'm not gonna name names, but some relatively well-known comics would call me up and say, I haven't been laid in 2 months. Can you give me 5 minutes?
Wow.
If you performed on that stage at Dublin's back in the late 90s, and the room was riddled with like hot chicks, supermodels, actresses, but also like librarians and like doctors and housewives and like it was a very random, eclectic group of people. But if you went up on stage and you controlled that room, you have to remember there was a no drink minimum and it was free to get in.
Whoa.
So there wasn't really any control. It was like a lion's den. So you had to go up with your chair and your whip and get people in the first couple seconds. And if you didn't, you had a bad set. But if you did, like a surfer, and you paddle out and you catch the wave and you start to surf and shred, 9 times out of 10, not only would you get laid, you'd probably get an agent out of it.
Wow.
So you'd see these comics come off stage, and then you'd see these hot chicks flock over, you know, to the backstage area by the bar where the comics would go.
Yeah.
Oh my God, you were so funny. This, that, the other thing. And then the comic would look at me and go.
Oh my God. Wow.
And then they inevitably, I would say 99.9% of the time, would go home with a girl because I would get a text message at like 3 a.m. or a phone call the next day. And, hey man, thank you so much. I ended up taking that hot blonde back to my place and we had a great time. I'm like, should I start charging for this shit?
I think you should. Yeah. Yeah. You could have made a killing. Are you kidding me?
But then it would be considered pimping and I don't want to get into that.
You weren't pimping the girls. You were pimping your comedian, the male comics. That's what you were pimping. The girls are not being pimped. The guys are. For once, let's pimp the guys. For once, let's do that. I'm all about that life.
So just to get back, just really quick to just kind of wrap up why I told you the story.
Yeah.
Pauly Shore came in one night.
Uh-huh.
Pauly Shore's mom is Mitzi Shore. She owned the Comedy Store when she was alive.
Yeah.
And he came in with like probably 5 or 6 really beautiful, but like kind of trashy, like Playboy playmates. And, you know, he had an entourage and the whole thing. And he was like, hey, buddy, this is cool, real buddy. I was like, oh, thanks. He's like, I said, do you want to perform tonight? He's like, yeah, I'd love to. Pauly Shore goes up on stage and kills it.
Wow.
Not necessarily because he was like the greatest comic, but he was, you know, he's a Hollywood novel. Mm-hmm. He's like the misfit of the comedy world who never goes away. He always just comes back and comes back. Sure. And I have a lot of love for Pauly. I lost a little bit of respect for him recently over something that happened at the Comedy Store, but that's neither here nor there. That's another podcast.
Oh, no, that's going to be this podcast. We're going to talk about it.
But... So he said, hey, guy, he came off stage and he was like, wow. You guys pack this place every Tuesday with hot chicks and celebrities. I mean, we had Vince Vaughn, Matthew McConaughey, Cole Hauser, Britney Spears,
wow.
Tom Morello, who's the guitar player for Rage Against the Machine. We had Jerry Cantrell, who's a rock. I mean, I'm just dropping names, but Dave Navarro. We had this weird eclectic group of Hollywood artists who would just happen to be famous, who wanted to go somewhere on a Tuesday night that was safe.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Because Fridays, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, that's the sort of bridge and tunnel
right.
crowd, right? All the schmucks from around come in, and, hey, we're in Hollywood. And
sure.
If you live in Hollywood, you don't want to be around that.
That's correct.
So all the cool people would go out Monday through Wednesday.
That was
the cool Hollywood night.
That's right.
You can go to clubs on any given night in the most random places, and that's when all the celebs would come out. So our comedy night was just kind of ended up being like that. We weren't trying to make it that.
Right.
And so Pauly said, why don't you guys bring this vibe over to my mom's club at the Comedy Store? We're like, great. So we took the best comics from Dublin's. So we had like Dane Cook, Sam Tripoli, Brett Ernst, you know, myself, Jay Davis would host, bop, 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 bop.
Yeah.
And then we did a show on Thursdays called Rock Comedy.
Rock Comedy?
Rock comedy. So instead of playing R&B and cool like hip hop and shit like that, wow. We only played rock and roll music in between the comics.
Okay.
But we only and always had rock and roll stars in our audience. You know, most of them like sober with their girlfriend. They just wanted a clean night out.
Right.
Like I remember Chris Cornell showing up one night from, you know, Chris Cornell.
I've heard of Chris Cornell.
he was Audioslave. He's friends with Tom Morello because they were in the band together. Yeah. Temple of the Dog, Soundgarden. Anyway, he showed up one night. I'm a huge fan of his. And I was just like, what the fuck are you doing here? And he couldn't have been nicer. But he, you know, he was going through sobriety at the time. So our comedy night was a place of clean relief for addicts, I think.
Yeah.
To an extent.
Right.
Anyway, I was performing one night on the same lineup as Brett Ernst and Sam Tripoli. And Mitzi Shore happened to be sitting in the back of the room and she caught our sets and she made us all paid regulars that night.
Amazing. That's incredible.
And then my journey, you know, continued for the next 16 years at the Comedy Store where I made great connections. I was hired for jobs. I hired people for jobs.
Yeah.
We started comedy tours. Access of Evil started there. Vince Vaughn's Wild West comedy show with John Caparello, Brett Ernst, Sebastian Maniscalco. You know, that all kind of came and groomed out from the Comedy Store. And then, you know, when she got older and sick and wasn't involved with it, it just, there was a changing of the guards and new management came in and I was, you know, kind of banished from the club because, you know, a lot of haters in the comedy world.
Yes.
So I had some people.
I'm quite aware of those, Ahmed. I have been experiencing those. So yes.
Yeah, I mean, when you get a text message from Adam Egit, who's the booker of the club, and he says, "I've been instructed by comedians to not book you." After Mitzi Shore is the one who gave me the blessing, and I spent 16 years of my life there, and then you want to pull that shit? It's like, go ahead, have your club.
Sure, absolutely.
Do you think? And by the way, to the credit of what they're doing over there.
Yeah.
They've never been more successful.
That's right. They've been killing. You know, there's no denying about that.
They're killing. Lines around the corner, big name acts. The problem is they lost their character. It's Mitzi Shore always wanted it to be a artist colony and a place to express your voice. You know, it's called show business. You got to have the show and have the business. But they took it. They took it to like a corporate and snobby level that I'm just not. I'm happy for them. I'm sure Mitzi's smiling in heaven that the place is making money. She ain't spending it, but they're making money.
Yeah.
So, you know, for that, I always loved the club and I loved her and I love some of the staff and stuff. But when the new management came in, it got toxic and parasitic.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I want to go back to the whole point about comedians calling you up and getting laid. Question. That is, I, by the way, the whole Mitzi story is amazing too. But I want to come back to that. Do you feel like, I mean, you must have a lot of groupies that like come after you after the show. I'm mean, stop it. Stop.
I'm almost 50.
You look great. You look at, okay, but when you were starting out, did you not have a lot of groupies? You must have had a lot of groupies. They didn't want a tall Arab guy? What's up?
I think with me, I think girls always looked at me as like their older brother or their cool uncle or some shit like that. And like, you don't want to try to hit on a girl.
You just met at who are coming to watch the show?
I'm just saying in general, I always give off that vibe like, you know, I'm like their friend.
Are you downplaying your coolness right now? Is that what's happening?
I have had my relationships and I've done my share of dating and I am very attracted to women's from all walks of life, but I don't have like a groupie, like I don't have chicks who like are groupies. Maybe I do and I just don't know it. You know what I mean? What is a groupie?
So I was at the Comedy Store. This is like quite a few years ago. And Chris D'Elia is standing there and he's like surrounded by like these really pretty girls.
Yeah. Chris D'Elia has groupies. I don't have groupies.
So I always thought that most male comics who go up and kill, especially in major comedy clubs, always have groupies. And I'm standing there and I'm watching this and I was like, man, I was like, female comics don't have groupies. And I remember having this conversation with Dom Herrera at Laugh Factory because we were sitting up and I think it was Dane Cook there. And all these like females were just like flocking and like fucking throwing themselves at this guy. And I was looking at Dom and I was like, Dom, like, do I get groupies eventually? Like, does that happen for me? Like, we have a bunch of dudes just throwing themselves at me. Like, does that happen for me? He's like, you'll have your groupies, Mona. You'll have your groupies one day, you know, in his like very Dom Herrera way. And I was like, oh, okay.
Don't worry about it. It's going to happen soon. Just relax.
Exactly.
Don't worry.
He's so sweet. I love Dom.
A few female comedians that have like guy groupies. Like I've worked with, and you know her, Crystal Marie.
Sure. Yes.
She came in like featured for me a few times and you know, we would do meet and greets and pictures after the shows. Everybody flocked to her, guys and girls.
Yeah.
She just has that energy about her, like that sort of Arab Marilyn Monroe, you know.
Yeah.
And I think people want to be around that but she also has like a lot of followers and she comes from a presenter background. But yeah, I think it all, you know, I was with Tammy Pescatelli recently and she has, you know, amazing groupies that love her and stuff. So I think, you know, the better you are at exposing your comedy and just stay funny and likable.
Yeah.
You know, if you want groupies, then that you'll get them.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Do you feel like today, let's say today, you were this young comic who went to the Comedy Store, do you think you would be passed today at the Comedy Store?
Well, that's a loaded question because Mitzi really is the kind of gatekeeper I thought when it came to that. Tommy was there for many years, and I thought he did a great job of grooming and passing a lot of comics, obviously with Mitzi's blessing. As she got older, she wasn't hands-on as much. But, you know, I auditioned for Mitzi in the Comedy Store in 1996, and I did not get passed.
Oh.
And then years later, and it wasn't 96? I can't remember. It was like early mid-90s. And then 5-6 years later, when she passed me, and I didn't audition. I was just doing our produced rock comedy bringer show. And I just was on stage and she caught me one night. It was like the stars were aligned.
Right.
And after she passed me, I said, you know, I auditioned for you 6 years ago. And she goes, yeah, you know, you weren't ready.
Wow.
So, you know, just kind of like, is everybody right when you think you're ready or not? I don't know, but I trust her. You know, she has decades of, you know, a track record of comics that she brought into her, you know, stable. Dave Letterman, Jay Leno, Richard Pryor, Robin Williams, you know, the list goes on and on. Paul Rodriguez, Whoopi Goldberg, Sandra Bernhardt. I mean, her hit list of comics that she really, you know, Jim Carrey, like she really gave people stage time and love. You know, she had a drug and alcohol, like anonymous foundation. She raised like $500,000 for to put comics through like drug and rehab. She's a very special person. You know, it's it was a sad loss when she left.
Yeah, I mean, I sadly never had the opportunity to meet her, or you know, she was too old, I guess, by the time I got around. But I used to hang out at the Comedy Store a lot. You know, I got the opportunity to produce my show, Minority Reports, which is what it is now because it started off at the Comedy Store, and you know, that was a really great opportunity. But I feel like, especially for us, I'm just talking about like brown female stand-up comics. I feel like there is a, I don't know what the expectation is of us. I feel like there is probably a lot more, I guess, acceptance of like male brown comics versus brown female comics. Like I've auditioned at the Laugh Factory 3 times. Like Jamie Masada keeps bringing me back, but just nothing ever happens. He's like, I really like you. I really want to pass you. I'm like, then fucking pass me. Like, I don't understand what the issue is.
Well, I'll tell you what the issue is. When you become really well known,
exactly.
No, because I was in the course of 6 months, I was banned from the Comedy Store and the Laugh Factory.
In the course of 6 months.
Yeah, so I was banned from the Laugh Factory in like early 2016. A couple months later, 6 months later, I had an issue with the Laugh Factory with Eric Griffin.
Yeah.
Who's a little punk ass bitch, I'll say it publicly. And I don't give two fucks about him. He's a parasite and a loser. And he did something to create friction between Jamie and I. At the time he was on TV, I wasn't. So Jamie went for the person that had more credibility. That happens in the comedy world. I understand that. That's one of the reasons I left Los Angeles, because I couldn't fucking like stomach that stuff anymore. Either you're straight up or you're not.
Right.
You know, take accountability, you know, be responsible for your actions. And Eric did something that was very disrespectful to me, and I called him out, and then he went and complained to Jamie. Jamie took sides with him. So, but when I first got passed, oh, just another Laugh Factory story, I auditioned there as well and didn't get passed. And then I was getting some TV and film credits. I was a paid regular at the Comedy Store. I was doing, you know, Friday, Saturday nights, 9, 10 p.m., main room, packed out, hitting them out of the park every night, name on the marquee, you know, that whole thing. And one night I went into the Laugh Factory to watch another comic. I can't remember who it was. Just went to watch because I never wanted to go in there. Jamie never, you know, would passed me. So I'm like, why would I start hanging out in here?
Yeah.
And then I saw him one night and he was like, buddy, how come you don't perform at La Factory? You would be perfect here, buddy. And I was like, I've been trying to get in this motherfucker for years. Like, what's the catch? Here's the catch. My name was on the marquee right down the street every fucking night. And I think I was on a TV show back then, and I just had more credit a bit. Like, I was on his radar. So he's a businessman. It's called show business.
Right.
Why don't you come perform here? And so for 12 years, I was a paid regular at the Laugh Factory. Not only there, Long Beach, Chicago. They had one at Scottsdale, Vegas. I was a Laugh Factory. I was part of the machine. And then, you know, one night, one incident can make all that go away. But, you know,
that incident, or is that too, if you don't want to talk?
No. Eric, I was talking to a bunch of comics upstairs. Eric walked into the conversation and started being really disrespectful and talking shit.
Towards you or toward all the comics?
Toward me. Yeah, and I don't want to talk about him too much because we're giving him power, but I did a lot for the guy. It made him a lot of money, exposed him a lot. Mm-hmm. And he's just a parasite. He takes. He's a fucking little bitch.
Yeah. But, that tends to be, there's a lot of people like that in Hollywood. Like, a lot.
Yeah, but I don't tolerate it. I can give two fucks who you are. Don't talk fucking down to me. Okay. Don't interrupt me when I'm in a fucking conversation that has nothing to do with you. Right. Jamie said, buddy, you were the aggressive one. I said, I was just sitting there having a conversation. He walked in. He said, next time, just walk away. And I said, why would I walk away from my own conversation, idiot? That's like being on stage and letting a heckler heckle you. And he goes, okay, the heckler got me. Bye, guys. Fuck you. Don't fucking interrupt my shit.
So would it have been different had you been on like some hit TV show and you were a regular and then
Absolutely.
Eric wasn't? And
Are
then he
kidding?
Would be like, hey, Eric,
Absolutely.
Please back off. Okay.
Look, unfortunately, the Comedy Store and Laugh Factory right now are operating on that level. TV credits, film credits, social media followers. Funny or not?
That's right.
You know, Comedy Store is what? It's the same 10 fucking white guys who perform there every week.
Pretty much. And they throw in one token white girl or one token Latina. And then they're like,
that's not diversity. That's not stand-up comedy. That's not global outreach. That's a fucking cult.
That's right. Yeah.
And you guys can all fucking, you know, do your little cult. I'm out.
Yeah. I'm totally with you. Do you feel like where do you think comedy, like this whole talk of diversity, right? Look, you were the first wave of diversity and then people, you know, comedians of my generation have come along and adding like more to that diversity. Where do you think this whole PC culture, okay? What do you think it's doing to comedy? Do you think it's just straight up killing comedy, or do you think it's good for comedy? Because those are diverse point of views, I guess, that are coming in and playing into the PC culture. Like, what do you think is happening?
Well, I think the internet definitely fed into that. I mean, there has always been a PC culture from day one, but the internet just put a magnifying glass on it. So is it killing comedy? Is it helping comedy? I don't know. I had somebody call 911 on me over a joke I told in Florida last year. But the good news is that it made global news and I got some great fucking press out of it. So, you know, sometimes, you know, God, the universe will throw you lemons and you make some goddamn lemonade. That's it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm a big fan of Lenny Bruce and I really stood for everything that he stood for. And I really believe in the fact of, you know, I feel like stand-up comedy is not just kind of treading water lightly, but actually doing the critical thinking. And to me, stand-up comedians are modern day philosophers. That's who we are. You know, there's no Tolstoy anymore. There's Ahmed. There's, you know, there's no more of, you know, Sophocles or whoever the great thinkers were. We are the great thinkers. People listen to more to stand-up comedians than they do to our politicians because stand-up comedians, A, make it funny, and B, tell the fucking truth. But you were just talking about this 911 call that was made on you. Can you talk a little bit about that? Where were you and what year was this? And
I mean, it's kind of better if you just go online and just Google Florida man calls 911 on Muslim comic. You'll see hundreds.
That's so expected. Yep. Fucking Florida. Of course it's Florida.
You'll see like hundreds of articles and Associated Press and links and video and interviews that I did. But in a nutshell, I used to do a joke where I would come out and I'd say, are any Middle Eastern people in the audience? And typically a few people will clap. And I said, that's great. There's a small group of us, but hey, it only takes one of us.
Oh my God.
And then it gets an awkward laugh like that. When I say, but seriously, lock the doors. And then that gets it.
Was it a man or a woman who called this?
It was a man. And the call, you can go on my website, ahmedahmed.com, again on my YouTube page. Somebody animated the actual call.
Oh, okay.
So a friend of mine who used to be a cartoonist for The Simpsons, he grabbed the actual call because it's public domain, and he animated it. It took him like 40 hours to animate it. But it's genius, and it's brilliant, and it's funny. But apparently, in the call, what he said that I said, oh yeah, I was at this comedy club last night. There was this comedian. His name's Ahmed Ahmed, and he's, you know, Middle Eastern. And last night, he asked if there were any Middle Eastern people in the audience, and everyone said, I'm from here, I'm from Iraq, I'm from here, I'm from there. He said, that's great. We can start our own little terrorist organization. I never said that. He just misconstrued the joke and took it out of context.
Wow.
And first of all, terrorists don't wear Under Armour.
They don't wear Under Armour?
Under Armour, like I, after my shows, I do meet and greets. Terrorists don't do meet and greets.
No, they don't.
So anyway,
They don't tell jokes on stage either. So
right, like, do you think ISIS was trying to recruit people from a comedy club stage in Naples, Florida? Doubt it.
No,
that's what happened. But then I took video of the cops who came to interview me, and then I posted it on Twitter, and it went viral. And then the news picked it up, so it became like global news, just for like 2 weeks.
That's
for
amazing. 2 weeks,
better than them. Yeah.
Listen, and all that free press, you can't beat that.
Thank you.
Praise be to Allah, is what we say.
Praise be to Allah, or praise be to the 911 caller.
Praise to the 911 caller, right? What are you, I mean, this whole pandemic has royally screwed up stand-up comedy. I mean, it's royally screwed up the world, actually. But how are you feeling about, like, you know, stand-up comedy and doing it on Zoom? I don't know. Have you done any shows on Zoom and online?
No.
How are you feeling?
No, I'm gonna stay away from that because I think all these, like, virtual comedy shows are killing comedy, to be honest.
Really? Why do you say that?
There's nothing better than just comedy in a live audience. And I think trying to stream it this way, unless you overproduce it with a laugh track or try to get, you know, some sort of people in the room, I just don't think, I'm trying to watch comedy live, you know, these live streams and stuff. Not funny.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard, right? It's hard to capture that same energy. Like, how do you capture it? I mean, you have a huge barrier called this Zoom and technology. How do you connect? Like, that's the most challenging part. I've been doing shows every Friday. Honestly, the turnout has been really great. Like, my objective was to showcase comedians from around the world, so not just U.S. So I have comedians calling in from the Middle East, comedians calling from U.K., comedians calling
from
India.
And that's Pakistan. Actually the cool. There is something cool about that, is bringing in people from all over the world. That is, I think, one of the good things that are happening during this pandemic. It is unifying people in a weird way. And,
yes.
And you're actually able to showcase. Like, we would have never been doing this as much as we are.
That's right.
Had it not been for this. So I think there's a bigger picture of, like, hey guys, you know, and there probably is a way to make it funnier and to make them successful. Yeah. It's just, nothing's better than live entertainment. That's it.
I 100% agree with you. I mean 100%. So now you're back in LA, and, like, do you have shows lined up for later this year? What's going on with you?
No, I mean, no, I don't think anybody does. And anybody who says they do is fucking delusional. Like, you just, I think we just have to wait it out. The there's a virus, you know, being spread around the world. So the virus is going to tell us when we can go back to work.
Yeah. Did you get tested?
Not a person or a man. What's that?
I agree with you. Did you get the free COVID test, the mouth swab?
I tried to, and they said I didn't have any symptoms, so they wouldn't test me. So I have to get a test for being asymptomatic and get an antibody test that might take a week. But why? Did you get tested?
Yeah, I did. I got my mouth swab.
Where?
Okay. There's a link. I'll send you the link if you want. And you just make an appointment. It's a drive through. You just stay in your car. They hand you a package. You do a mouth swab and you drop it. End of story. 30 minutes. You're out.
And how long do you find out your results?
I think it takes about maybe a week or maybe less.
Oh, so you just got it done today?
Yesterday.
And where is this drive-through?
I went to the Christian center, like this huge parking lot. Like, I think it was like downtown somewhere. And then
downtown LA.
Downtown LA. Yeah. Downtown LA. Yeah. I'll send
you. Please do. Because I was trying to find it. I went online. They like diagnosed me. They're like, yeah, you don't have any symptoms. We're just only doing high risk, you know, patients and all this. And I'm like, well,
no, everybody's getting tested in LA. That's what Garcetti. Okay. Everybody's getting tested, which I honestly feel like the only way we're going to come out of this freaking pandemic is that everybody should be getting tested. And of course, then everybody has to get vaccinated once they come up with the vaccine. Otherwise, there's no fucking way we're coming out of this. I mean, look, I have four older brothers and two of my brothers, my second and my third brother, were given expired vaccination for polio in Pakistan, and they ended up getting polio because of it, right? So, So I guess in a way, if it wasn't for polio, I wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation with you. So that's kind of the horrible but silver lining in that sense. So I feel like vaccines are super important, and everybody's trying to work on it, and whoever comes up with it is gonna make a lot of money. So. So this is the time when I regret not going into medicine. So, cause I'm just like, dude, I could be like making a killing now, but I'm a former finance girl. Did you go to college?
No, I went to theater art school for a year. I went to the Academy of Dramatic Arts. I went to junior college for about a year and a half, but I didn't really take it seriously.
You didn't take the drama school seriously?
No, my college days, my minimal college days, I did not. I just wasn't interested in college. I didn't think it was going to move my career forward. So I was just like,
Were you a good student in school? Like, were you like a B, C student or D student or?
I barely graduated from high school.
Really?
Yeah. I actually went to my psychology teacher. I needed a 2.0 to graduate. I had a 1.9.
And
I went to my psychology teacher. I don't know if I should say his name. I went to one of my teachers and I was like, hey, I'm not going to graduate. You gave me a C+. He was a really nice teacher. I just didn't apply myself a lot in his class, but I was a good student. I said, you gave me a C+. Is there any extra credit work I can do where I can bump my GPA up so I can walk and get my diploma? You know, 1,000 people are going to be there. I need to appear for that.
Yeah.
And they were like,
Riverside, he was like, right? This is a Riverside High School?
Yeah. John W. North High School. And he goes, well, there's not enough time for you to turn in any extra credit work, but I don't want to be the one to hold you back in life. I know you're going to do great things. And he, right there on the spot, erased C+ and gave me a B-. And then I got to graduate from high school, and I got to get my diploma. I was like number 2 or 3 that they called out because alphabetical order.
Yeah, exactly.
And I got a standing ovation.
You did?
Swear to God, I got a standing O when I got my diploma.
Who was giving you the standing O? What do you mean?
I was destined to be a stand-up comic.
Oh, know? Jesus. Standing O? Oh, man. My graduation was traumatic as fuck. It was, like, weird. Because I moved at, like, okay, first of all, Who the fuck sends their kid at the age of 15 to America and be like, go to high school, good luck. And, you know, you go to high school. I went to inner city high school in Jersey City. Don't go to Jersey City. I don't know if you've ever been there.
I've been.
I'm so sorry. I went to high school in Jersey City, and it was atrocious. We were so poor. Like, we lived next to the projects. We went to this shitty-ass high school. And I remember, like, the day of my graduation, my parents didn't live in Pakistan. My parents lived in Pakistan, and I lived here with my brothers. And literally the day of my graduation, my mom had to fly back to Pakistan, and she couldn't even be here for my graduation. So I was just, like, standing there. By the way, there was nobody at my graduation. None of my family came. Nobody. I was just like an asshole, like alone, just walking to the stage, just taking my diploma and just turning around to like an empty seat, like nobody. And that has been my entire life, like just looking back to family to empty chairs. That's it. That's my entire family dynamic and family relationship. But I don't know. I think. Do you think stand-up comedy can be taught? I don't think it can be, but what do you think?
No, I don't think you can teach it. I think you can give people notes and, like, advice and wisdom and little tricks of the trade, but can you teach somebody to be funny? No, I don't think so.
Can you?
But I think that you can watch. I think you have a natural funny bone in you.
Yeah.
And you can study the art form of it and then pick up tricks of the trade and find your own voice. Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think you and I had touched upon it before, but you feel like pain and trauma contributes to good or great comedy?
Oh, 100%. Nothing's funny in comedy unless it's uncomfortable to listen to or watch.
Right. I mean, does it bother you when you see stand-up comics who, like, come from really good, stable families and, like, grew up with money, and then they're, like, trying to be funny on stage, and you're like, dude, there's nothing funny about this shit. Like, you grew up in privilege. Fuck you. Do you feel that way?
Yeah, I mean, no. I've met people that grew up privileged that still have funny stories. You know, it's all about delivery and timing and your perspective and point of view, you know? Yeah. Ellen DeGeneres, her last special was brilliant because it was called Relatable.
Right.
And she was trying to let everybody know how relatable she was, but she's really not because she's a fucking billionaire.
Yeah.
So when she's telling her stories about shimmying across the bathroom floor on a towel, have you heard this joke?
No, I haven't.
Have you seen her special?
I haven't seen it yet, no.
Watch her special. I'm not going to ruin it for you, but she has a whole bit about how big her bathroom is, how big her house is, how privileged of a lifestyle she lives. But it's done in a backhanded way.
Yeah.
And it's really clever. And I laughed out loud. It was the first time I laughed out loud at a comedy special in a while.
Yeah.
Also, her timing and delivery is impeccable. So to answer your question, no, I think if you come, it doesn't matter what background you come from. Funny is funny. If you can make it funny, you know, make it funnier.
Yeah. I mean, how much has pain and trauma contributed in you becoming a stand-up comic and continuing to, and how much?
All of it. Every single thing I talk about has some sort of traumatic, painful, uncomfortable, sticky situation, you know, that you're regurgitating, you know?
Right.
You take the hit and swallow it. And then you digest it and you reflect on it and then you talk about it.
Yeah.
And then people laugh and you go, can't believe, you know, you guys agreed to with that or whatever it was.
Right. I mean, you and I talked about like growing up with like physical abuse and like growing up with like ass whoopings and shit. I don't know. Do you talk about that on stage? Like getting your ass whooped as a kid?
I used to younger. I thought about bringing it back. I just got caught up in other material and it was just stuff I kind of just put in the closet, and I was like, oh, I'll reach back into that later.
Right, because you've also evolved so much as a person, so you want to talk about the things that are more relevant to you now versus what was
happening
before.
Right.
I mean,
by the way, not just to interject really quick, I need to have a heart out soon.
Yeah, I'm gonna wrap up in like 5 minutes, and then we can.
Okay, cool.
We can just call it.
Okay, give me one, just because I have a phone call coming in. And I got a meeting, but give me just one sec.
Yeah, sure.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, all good. All good. Of course, nobody has shows lined up. Are you back? Do you have any TV or stuff that you've been working on? Any TV or film stuff? Or what's going on with you?
Nope. I'm just waiting for this thing to, you know, allow us to go back to, like, real physical work. And in the meantime, just here online.
Yeah. And you're in what? Where are you now? Venice?
Yep. Venice Beach.
Venice Beach. What made you, have you always lived in Venice Beach? Have you always been around Venice Beach or?
No, I just found a unit that was available and I jumped into it. There's not much going on because nobody can go out. The beaches are closed. You can't do shit. So.
Right. Yeah. I like the beach life. Well, where can we find you, Ahmed? Do you want to?
Instagram at Ahmed Comedy, AHMED Comedy. Twitter, the same, at Ahmed Comedy. My website's ahmedahmed.com. I'm on Facebook. I'm going to soon be doing a sort of kind of what you're doing, a streaming podcast that will go out to all the platforms. So stay tuned for that. That's it.
That's awesome. By the way, I've always wanted to ask you, is Ahmed Ahmed a stage name or is that an actual birth?
So my real name is Ahmed Abu Bakr Ahmed Muhammad Ali Abdul Wahab Kawadia.
What? How many names is that?
7. So when, you know, in Egypt and other brown cultures, they oftentimes will use their fathers and forefathers' names to trace back your lineage and heritage. So when my dad got his immigration papers in 1970, you know, the immigration officer was like, you know, you get 3.
Yeah.
Can't have 7. You get 3. Beginning, middle, and last.
Sure.
So my mom just liked the name Ahmed so much because it's short for Muhammad, which means thank God.
Yeah.
And Ahmed means the one who thanks God. And Prophet Muhammad, my mom was a very religious Muslim woman. Prophet Muhammad was known, his friends and close friends and family would call him Ahmed. That was like his nickname.
Okay.
Like Bob and Robert.
Got it. Right. So your full name is Ahmed Abu Bakr Ahmed?
Yeah.
Got it. And then you were just like, okay, Abu Bakr is too much. Let's cut Abu Bakr out. Let's just make it Ahmed.
For Hollywood, yeah.
Well, you know, if it makes any sense, my agent in the late 90s or early 2000s told me that I couldn't use my ethnic last name, which is Sheikh. She wanted me to cut it short to Shay, Shay. So I was Mona Shay for a little bit, and I hated it because people are like, "You're not Irish." I'm like, "You're absolutely correct. I'm Black Irish." I was just like, "You know what? Fuck this. I'm going back to my ethnic name." And thank God for diversity making, you know, things the way it is. So, Ahmed, man, thank you so much for joining me. This is really awesome. We're gonna do it again. We're gonna bring you back again, and we'll do another podcast. So
yeah, I'm gonna message you. Let's do an IG live soon.
Yeah, I'm down. I'm totally down.
Okay. All right. Cool.
Thank you for tuning in.
Thank you, dear.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a great day. All right.
You too.
See you later. Bye. That was the amazing Ahmed Ahmed. Thank you so much for joining us for this podcast. I will see you guys next week. Don't forget to subscribe to our channel for Minority Report. Watch, like, subscribe, share it with your friends. I'm bringing in artists from around the world, not just the US, not just from the West, but also from the Middle East, across the board. That's what we want. Artists, change makers, you name it, we're going to bring them. Thank you very much for tuning in. I'll see you guys next time.